Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. Tonight we continue to look back at our favourite moments from the past year. In July we brought you a two-part NAIDOC Week special. The theme, Because of Her We Can, allowed us to reflect on the selfless contributions Indigenous women have made and continue to make to our lives. We took the opportunity to revisit some of my favourite conversations with the many wonderful Indigenous women we've had on the show. So tonight I thought we'd take a look back once more. I grew up with strong connections to the Redfern community. In October of 2016, I caught up with Auntie Millie Ingram. She spoke with me about her time working in Redfern in the 1970s.
We were all working in factories and we were all really, it was really good friendship with La Perouse as well, because a lot of the La Perouse women came and worked in a lot of the factories in here. So there was that good camaraderie between La Perouse and Redfern. And on the weekends we would play football. And, of course, you'd turn up and everybody knew each other there, and that was always really good back in those days in the late 50s and early 60s. And so I've still got some friends out of La Perouse. We're all getting pretty old now, but we're still here. We still have those memories, and their children remember us too because of parents talking. And that was great, and I think that will remain, and it still remains between the football relationship between La Perouse and Redfern.
And tell us a little bit about how you started to then really get involved with the Indigenous community organisations.
I think we can mostly pinpoint that to Charlie Perkins coming here and setting up the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And I had had some problems in the factory. I was a really good worker. And when I got sacked for something that was so trivial, it was just ridiculous. And I never thought about it being racism. I just thought that the poor lady did the wrong thing, so I called the union in, and I won that fight against that person and that company of getting my job back. So that was about 1960, and so that was a good little win for me, and sort of I think that's what put the fire in the belly. But that goes back further, because my father was a shearer, and he was always fighting for his rights as a shearer, as I think most Aboriginal men did back in those days. And he always told us when we started to work to make sure you join the union.
Do you think there's a different style of Indigenous women's leadership?
I absolutely. We've always said that we can't fight against our men, because that would be another division that we can't afford. There's too few of us. But we don't accept anything that the men do, if it's domestic violence or anything like that. But the women were, you're quite right, they were the silent achievers. And my mum fought against the mission manager all the time, because if the mission manager, if he had a bad day, he would keep the rations back. And we would go hungry for days on end until he saw fit to give us the slip to get our rations so we could have something to eat. And my mum rounded up all the women on the mish, took them down to the police station and asked the police to move the mission manager to give the ration slips out so we could eat. And she said, I'm not going home to my children starving again. And so the police sergeant at the Cowra police station had rang the welfare board and said, you want to do something about this mission manager up here because he's starving these women and children. So my mum initiated it. The police officer was really good because he knew mum. She knew mum to be a good person. And the mission manager complained that he lost his job over her.
Well, you guys have been making trouble for decades.
Still do.
Yes, well, you are. But, I mean, you must look back at Redfern, how it was when you arrived there and where it is now. And, you know, obviously you've been one of the key elders who've been facilitating the changes that have happened there. But when you look back over that period, where do you see the most positive changes as having come from?
The positive changes are the growth of the people. I think all of those people, Charlie Perkins started up the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And he used to have all these gatherings down there, whether they were dances, sing-alongs or concerts, and just even giving out some welfare support and helping them to get homes and things like that. Nearly all of our leaders of today and those leaders in the 60s went to Charlie Perkins' Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs, and that's, I think, where they honed their knowledge about their rights and their human rights in this country. And I admire all those people. We know all the young fellows that were there, and even Gary Foley says the same thing, you know. That's where he grew up, him and Gary Foley, Gary Williams, Billy Craigie and Mike Landerson, all of them. Redfern was where they started to kickstart it all. But I think it's because of Charlie coming and telling them that they had their rights and they had their human rights in this country.
I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what you see the role of Indigenous community controlled services as being. Why are they so important to an Aboriginal community?
They're so important because they belong to the Aboriginal people. They have ownership over it. And it gives them a little bit of power over their own lives. Now, my belief is that it started from the Tent Embassy. And that's why I'll always absolutely support the Tent Embassy in Canberra. Because after the referendum, we expected all these wonderful things to happen. And I think that a lot of the people who started off the medical service, people like Fred Hollows and others and that probably said, well, we've got the referendum now, what are we going to do? But the government didn't do anything. The government didn't, and the government's still not doing anything, right? But the people, a fellow Australian, started to say, well, we've got to do something. And they helped to start the medical service off, and with Mum Shirl and Dr. Sykes and Naomi Mayers and all of them, really good people. But like the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs started off with support from non-Aboriginal Australians, but they handed it over to Aboriginal control when it was the right time. And that was good, and that happened with the legal service, the medical service and the Foundation for Aboriginal Affairs. And they've happened ever since, because what happened is that Aboriginal people weren't getting the health care they needed because of severe racism, and Aboriginal people were going to jail far too often, and so they're without legal support. And I think what we have to do today is still ask, why are so many Aboriginal people in custody? My belief on that is that it's an industry. It's an industry that if you want to have jails and you want to privatise them and you want somebody else to run them, you got to have the fodder. And they won't cut down on their entitlements, funding entitlements. They will continue to arrest Aboriginal people for mediocre stuff without giving those people their rights. It's a disgrace on this country. It's an indictment on this country, and I think we should broadcast this internationally as much as possible, how they're violating the human rights of our young people here in this country, and all because of their industry, want to keep their people in jobs. They can reinvest that. If they reinvested that into cultural camps with educational programs, cultural programs, so they can go out and understand the land and their own culture, combined with educational programs so they can fit into the white world if they want to, those educational camps would be beneficial for government as well, because they won't be having to pay billions of dollars out for prisons and the support staff in the prisons to keep them there that is primarily there to incarcerate Aboriginal people.
I'm Robert McClellan and I'm speaking Tarabalang language, celebrating NAIDOC Week on ABC Radio.
I came to Sydney when I was 16 years old and then got different jobs in cleaning and whatever, and then I finally landed a job as a nanny, which lasted me forever and a day, and I had to cook for the family, so really I taught myself to cook. And then when I was 31, I went back and got an education and I became a teacher. And I went into the hospitality side of it and taught at TAFE for 20-odd years, but with a focus on taking the education back to the community, because my home in Sydney was on the block. And Redfern is my home no matter where I go, apart from my homeland in Walgett, New South Wales. So Walgett and Redfern are my home grounds. And that enables me to take the education back to the community, because my thing with education is if you have an education, you have a voice, you have a choice. Other than that, you have attitude and anger. So within doing saying that, I've been able to, with my colleagues and my support around me, we've been able to then link up and provide jobs for our students that we train, which is the most positive thing But in my life, it's only taken me 30 years to link up with corporate world. But it's being done, and now we have a lot of support in corporate and other businesses, small businesses around Redfern in close by. And yes, and NCIE is just about the greatest place that we can have in Redfern, because it's now we're expanding JobReady into the other programs and the other businesses that we run within NCIE. We do employ our trainees when they come out within NCIE, and then when they choose to go on their own journey, then we're still there to support them.
One thing that's always been evident by the way that you do your work, Aunty Beryl, is that you have a real commitment to giving back to the community. Why is that so important for you?
Well, when I came to Sydney as a 16-year-old girl, the elders on the block looked after us. There was quite a few of us, and we became extended families with one another, and we still do, and we are still all friends who the people that are left that are around my age group. We've always maintained that, and we still will. We still support one another. And that's was my passion, to give back to the community, to make sure that the generations after us had a choice. And that's been from day one. And not only that, it's expanded out into my hometown in Walgett and other places, and I've been able to travel to other countries and meet up with Indigenous people from all over the world. So we've all shared, and it's, we've all got something in common, and that's our land and what we grow on it, what our forefathers have survived off it with, and we have to maintain that. And I think by doing what we're doing, getting back to eating fresh food, and I can see the change all over the world, that's what's happening. And I'm very passionate about it because, you know, Mother Earth gives us everything, so we have to look after it.
One of the ways you've helped the community, as we've mentioned, is through the NCIE JobReady initiative. How did JobReady come about?
JobReady come about when Frank Sato made me an offer. I was retired. And then I said to Frank, okay, we'll do it for 1 year, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then that's it. But it's been working now. It's been 11 years I've been doing it.
And can you just explain how the program works?
The program works like this. We do a certificate two in hospitality. So they come out with the certificate two, and then we place them into jobs. And then some of them go into apprenticeships. Some of them just go into, they want to work back a house in a hotel, or they want to work in a little coffee shop. I now have a partnership with Uluru. They want to go up there and have that experience, or I always tell them that to have the experience and they can always come home. So now we've got some of our students that have been up there for 8-9 years, working permanently up there, living there, and some of them go up and have 6 months and have a choice and they come back home. And some of those students are now working in hotels with a call around the city area. And NCIE, when they come out of doing this certificate two, do their work experience with us, and then we offer them some part-time hours in the kitchen or customer service, and that's how it works. But the JobReady program is a stepping stone, and to build up your self-esteem and self-confidence, and then you can go on your own journey, whether it be in hospitality, and not all the students go into hospitality. We've had people come out with their RN, their registered nursing now, and they go into other areas. So we do have a big variety of jobs that they can go into.
What advice would you give to a young Indigenous person who's aspiring to get into the hospitality industry?
I would say if you want to become a chef or go into hospitality, it is just an amazing career that you can go into. You don't have to be there all your life, but you've got lots and lots of opportunities. It's just not working in a kitchen. It's a lot of other things. You might want to go and work on Qantas. You might want to go and set up your own business, but there's a lot of opportunities. People think it's just about cooking and food, But you can go into parks and wildlife. You can go into working on a cruise ship. You can go into all sorts of things. It's just an amazing. And what it does do, it gives you an opportunity to travel.
Oh, so many incredible women.
She was one of those people who was before her time.
You know, it's just the little things, you know, the impact that she had on me as a child.
It was like I had two mums.
NAIDOC 2018, celebrating the leadership of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women.
My sister-in-law, when she sat me down at the table having my own little spelling contest every night, I think that was a huge influence on me because that's where I learned to value learning. Even though I hated it at the time, I want to be out smashing the streetlights with the other kids and she wouldn't let me go. Now I just thank God she was there. People like Aunt Isabel Flick, you know, who's long gone now, but she was a huge influence on my life. My mum, because of what she went through, my dad was an extremely violent man to my mum, and she just stood up, and I don't think I've ever met a person like my mother. She was someone who's had such strength of character. At the end of the day, and I've said this for many, many years now, is that the backbone of the Aboriginal struggle have been Aboriginal women. They're the ones that really held it together.
NAIDOC 2018, celebrating the leadership of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women.
As an undergraduate student from a working poor family in the outer suburbs, I had to finance my university life. Contrary to popular opinion, university does not come free to all black people. So I had to work in semester breaks as a research assistant to make money, and it just so happened that I could do research. And I had a really supportive academic staff around me, Dr. Mark Brough, of course, Professor Cindy Shannon, who were working on research at that time and engaging me and working on that both during my undergrad but also continuing to encourage me to come back and do honours and do a PhD. But the funny thing is the only reason I did a PhD was I wanted to have kids. So I thought, well, this will keep me busy while I have kids and still continue my career. But the driver of the research question that I had was I was sick of doing research work for research that had particular assumptions about us that I then had to reproduce this knowledge that I knew was inherently violent, and that is constantly asking our mob to testify to how bad we are. That made me sick as a research officer doing that, and I know it made the mob sick when I had to go and do that kind of work. So I was motivated by a desire to lead a research agenda that was informed by my understanding of what it means to be an Indigenous person and to speak back to the kind of stuff, the text that we read, and it doesn't matter what discipline you're in, whether it's health or education or whatever, the texts that we read in our universities about us are inherently violent. And I wanted to be part of reproducing new texts or producing new texts that tell the truth about who we are.
Can I just press you on that a little bit and get you to explain from your own perspective what a difference it's made to have Indigenous people leading research and asking the questions?
Well, I'll tell you like a quick little yarn about why black presence is important beyond just this whole idea of equity and stuff. So I used to be a smoker, and since the age of 14, I was smoking on and off. And I worked in a health service as a researcher. And every, you know, month or so, we'd get a report about how bad the smoking rates were in our community of Benalla. And they were close to 60% and then some for the adult smoking population, which is really, really, really high. And everyone would go, those, you know, if only they just quit smoking. And so these stats were used to remind us of how bad the blacks are. And as a smoker, I was like, you know, there's got to be an answer to this. I know that I'm not a bad person. I'm a health professional, but I struggle with smoking. And what's going on here? Why aren't we fixing this problem? So what I did is I got a small research grant from IATSIS back when they used to give research grants to black people. Anyway, so that was the start of my career as an independent researcher. But I got a small grant, and what I did is I decided to go and interview black fellas in Inala who had quit smoking because maybe they knew something that we didn't as health professionals about how to quit. And if you were living in a community where six to seven out of 10 adults that you encounter all smoke and you quit in that environment, then there's you've got something to tell us. So I accepted that perhaps smokers and ex-smokers have something to teach us as health professionals about how to support them to give up. So I did these yarns with people about how they quit, and their quitting stories were so amazing and interesting and really contradicted mainstream health promotion messages. So none of them quit on the basis of health risk or illness. And those of us who smoke or have smoked don't smoke because we have this misguided belief that somehow it's doing something good for our bodies. We don't need to be told about health risks anymore. I think we kind of get it. That's not why people are smoking. And so we got the stories. And what was interesting was that significant life event that reconfigured their identity and made them reassess their smoking identity, therefore, was the main hinge factor. But a caring and supportive relationship with a healthcare professional was also a really important part of that. And so people talked about being actually surprised when a health professional didn't rouse on them for relapsing, how they supported them and encouraged them, and that helped them get through. Because you have to quit many times to successfully quit. Anyway, so we then spoke to all of our doctors and nurses in the health service and said to them, we need to change the dialogue, change how we talk to smokers and look at the opportunities for encouraging quitting behaviour and all the supports and that kind of thing. Small study, 10 years on, the adult smoking rate in that clinic population is over 10% less than what it was at the time we did the study. Now, that's a significant decline that's more significant than the national decline in Indigenous smoking rates. That was just a very small study where we went, can Black people tell us something about how to do this better? And the answer is yes. And how easy is that? So I see my presence not as a equity project, as a capacity building project. We have different questions that we want to ask that don't have as a starting point that there is something inherently wrong with Black people.
Another area where you've done a lot of work is thinking about how within the higher education space, it can be a much more conducive and welcoming environment, a proactive environment for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students and teachers. What are some of your main observations in that space?
Look, we held a symposium recently about Black presence in the academy, and I had a bit of a debate and a conversation about why as an Indigenous academic I choose to be in Indigenous spaces. And I talk about being good in the hood, and that I'm good in the hood not because I'm not good enough to be anywhere else. I'm good in the hood because I like to be around mob. It just makes it safer. It means that there's someone who gets you without you having to do Aboriginality 101 course with them in the course of having a conversation. People don't understand the importance of these spaces, and we've had conversations recently around cultural safety and culturally safe spaces that are inherently problematic and false. But when you're a minority, having these spaces just to be, to not be interrogated, surveilled, questioned, you know, demonised, dismissed, has been so very important. So for me, it's about creating a community in the academy for our students, but for academics, and about being good community members for each other. So I'm focused now less so much on what the institution can do for us, but how we as Black fellas, as this emerging critical mass, what do we do for each other? How do we speak to each other? How do we take care of each other?
That's researcher and Indigenous health expert Dr. Chelsea Bond. She's just one of the inspirational women that we've featured on the program since 2016. And you also heard from Redfern Elders Auntie Millie Ingram and Auntie Beryl Van Oplu.
Join the conversation online, facebook.com/ABC Speaking Out.
Look, listen and learn knowledge.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, Radio National, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Radio app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Tonight we're looking back at one of my favourite programs from the past year. In July we brought you the first of a two-part special celebrating the NAIDOC theme, Because of Her, We Can. It was an opportunity to revisit my favourite conversations with some of the most inspirational and dedicated Indigenous women in the country. Each of them is either a mother, auntie, daughter, or a combination of all three. Let's hear now from Amanda Porter. Amanda's work on Aboriginal community responses to crime highlights the impact of a community-led approach.
For a long time, I've been interested in the way different geographical areas, different populations, different issues are policed in quite different ways. But then when I was at university is really when I started to get into these issues more. In particular, I started studying criminology, and that's when I learned I loved criminology, because it was my first chance to where I think Indigenous justice issues were really front and centre, where there was subjects within the course about the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And I guess I'd always followed examples of deaths in custody and reform, but it was only in this class that these issues were given the full attention that such issues deserve. I guess the thing that struck me at the time was that a lot of the discussions were about policing reform that was top down. So how to make the police more culturally competent, how to reform laws that police enforce. And these, of course, are hugely important issues. But at the same time, there was less information available about Indigenous justice initiatives that were running, and that I think even it's fair to say today that there isn't that much information out there about the many hardworking individuals out there in community that are doing this as their bread and butter every single day.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, for some people too listening, they might not be familiar with the concept of a night patrol. So can you just explain how they work?
If you were to cut it down to what a basic definition of Indigenous security or of night patrols or alternative policing was, it's that they're Indigenous-owned initiatives which are targeted to improve safety for Indigenous people in a particular community. So they might be involved in such diverse activities as patrolling the streets and trying to look out for young people and question why they're around, take them if they improve issues such as homelessness. They might be looking out for young kids that fall through the cracks of the system and inquire as to why they are not accessing particular services. But I think one thing I learnt in this work was that they do a lot more than just policing.
Why is this such an effective form of community policing?
I think it comes down to strong cultural leadership. And I saw that in many of the sites that I visited, in particular in Redfern and in Bourke. These are initiatives that were led by strong local Indigenous governance that benefited from the wisdom and local expertise of elders. Other things that make it work was just the dedication and commitment of individuals. It's something that's really hard to, you know, I guess, write policy for. And I think it comes down to those ingredients of cultural leadership, self-determination and committed individuals.
That's right. You can't legislate for an Auntie Brenda in every community, can you?
No.
Just wondering what your thoughts are on why these community-based approaches to policing aren't actually utilised more.
Well, first of all, one thing that's very sad is that I think these elements about why it is that these initiative works aren't always picked up on, and they're not always translated to government entities. So something that I learned slowly over the years was that this is not just a policing initiative, this is so much more, and it would really sell the hard work of these people short just to see it as a justice initiative when really it's about linking up people to services, providing care, mentoring, all these other social aspects of the work. So when I look at the way different funding agencies and these, you know, initiatives are often funded by several entities, or often not funded at all. Some are just run literally on the smell of an oily rag and in-kind contributions and nothing more. But often when these are evaluated, it's through the lens of crime prevention, for example. And to look at this as crime prevention, I think, sells short the holistic service that I think the people involved in the everyday management of the service would see it as.
What do you think are some of the things that need to be present to build a good relationship between the community and the police?
In terms of building the capacity to do this work, it's really important that they are taken seriously, first of all. So I think one issue that comes up routinely is that these services are underfunded. Quite often there is a lot of goodwill in a community and these initiatives are run on an entirely volunteer basis. Many of the patrols that I saw had annual incomes of less than $30,000. $50,000 was considered more of the upper end of the scale. So these aren't expensive or onerous on the taxpayer budget, but yet it's hard for these services to continue to exist if they don't receive adequate funding to continue.
And actually, when you say that, that doesn't cost much to run them, and you think of what you've described in terms of crime prevention, they're actually incredibly cost-effective if you wanted to go down the economic analysis road. But Indigenous criminologists are a fairly new thing. Mm. What are you hoping having more Indigenous criminologists will bring to the discipline?
Well, I'm hoping it'll be an opportunity for us to look at these issues in a new light. These are, I think, the most important social justice issues of our time. When we look back in 50 years' time at issues such as mandatory detention, deaths in custody, ongoing effects of stolen generation, I think these will be classified as the most important issues of our social era, and it's really important that these issues are front and centre. And to me, what has always been interesting about criminology as a discipline is the ability to create crimes and to look at crimes through a new light. So one of my favourite criminologists studying as an undergraduate was Edwin Sutherland, who very few people would know of, but he was a criminologist who looked at white-collar offending, and he actually created the offence of embezzlement and fraud. And I think it's really telling, I think, that when you look at the current rates of Indigenous incarceration and Indigenous overrepresentation, and then you look at some of the laws that the current very draconian and retrogressive laws, and I'm thinking in particular about the Fines, Penalties and Infringement Notices Act in Western Australia, where you see the majority of Indigenous women in prison for such petty things as fine default. And often, you know, with this legislation, you don't need to, you know, someone can be put in police custody without having seen a magistrate, without having seen a judicial officer. It's a law which is bad for many reasons. And I'm thinking also about the paperless arrest laws in the Northern Territory. And when you look at the circumstances of some of the recent deaths, you know, because these aren't just laws, people have died as a result of these laws.
Oh, so many incredible women.
She was one of those people who was before her time.
You know, it's just the little things, you know, the impact that she had on me as a child.
It was like I had two mums.
NAIDOC 2018, celebrating the leadership of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women.
There are so many, but first and foremost, the gong, if you like, goes to my mum, Esme Nasser Mokak, who passed away early from end-stage renal disease, but she was really my greatest teacher. But when I look at the amazing women in my life in terms of work, I've had the privilege of having our stellar Aboriginal woman person in Dr. Laotra O'Donoghue as a patron for both AIDA and the Laotra Institute. In fact, she gifted her name to the Laotra Institute. We are absolutely indebted to Laotra. But I've had the last 13 years of my life having a very close and very supportive and at times very robust relationship with Laotra. You know, if you're working with and under Laotra, you've got to have your skates on. And that's been wonderful.
NAIDOC 2018, celebrating the leadership of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women.
Well, you know, I'm a national ambassador of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation, and obviously now working quite closely with the Hawthorne Football Club in terms of what they do. And I will actually be going to Catherine in La Jumanu actually in a couple of weeks to run a workshop with the Big River Hawks, who are the junior team for Hawthorne, and that will be an ILF project, and we will produce a book that which will then be sold, and monies will go back into literacy projects. So it, for me, from an Epic Good perspective, and knowing the work that Stuart and Kathy want to do through their foundation, and understanding the need to link literacy and sport, because I see a lot of young people in remote communities who are brilliant athletes and particularly AFL footballers, but may not have the literacy skills that will require them to have a full empowered life. So I also do a lot of work in schools, and teachers often say to me when they set assignments for their students and they want them to pick an Indigenous role model, they're nearly always sports people. So I think there's a real need to marry and find ways to broker relationships between sporting codes, all sporting codes, and literature and literacy. So in Darwin this year, earlier this year, some Hawthorne players actually presented kids from Tiwi Island with book packs from our Book Buzz and read to them. And so that was the first step in the relationship between Hawthorne in particular and the ILF, and that will grow over time. But what we're looking at in the next for Reconciliation Week, to celebrate Reconciliation Week, to celebrate Indigenous Round, which is now known as Sir Doug Nicholls Round, and to celebrate the relationship between the ILF and Epic Good, is we're having a gala event in Brisbane where book lovers and footy lovers will come together, and just, you know, mob from the community will come together to actually raise awareness and raise funds for the ILF.
Now, you've recently shared a sneak peek of one of your books, Kicking Goals with Goodsy and Magic, which tells of the friendship between these two AFL legends, Adam Goodes and Michael O'Loughlin. Can you tell us a bit about why you felt it was important to tell this story and how you got involved in the collaboration?
Yes, it's interesting because I can't remember when I first met Adam and Michael some years ago, because I vaguely remember Adam calling me auntie at a performance at the State Theatre one night.
Well, you wouldn't have forgot that, would you?
No, and I said to him, don't you ever do that in public again. And I think he was in his 20s and I was obviously much younger. I have long wanted to do – I've known Michael for some time. We've been on a board together at the National Aboriginal Sporting Chance Academy. I read his memoir – where I learned a lot about the psyche of elite athletes, but he gave lots of wise words, particularly to young people, about managing racism, you know, managing not with your fists. And I was asked to do a kid's book with Mickey O, and I was sitting there talking to the publishers, and I said, why don't we do like the two of us that we'll see in the weekend papers, where you'd have two people who are lifelong friends, they're interviewed separately with the same questions to see their recollections and so forth. So we basically took that. I text Adam and Michael from the meeting and said, do you want to be part of this? And like, yes, awesome, great. And so it was quite easy to pull that together. And I had the joy of interviewing them. They're both incredibly funny. And we might not see that in the public domain often, but they're very, very funny. Varying levels of humility and talking about each other is very, very funny. But also, like, I wanted to get some dirt if they were naughty when they were at school, because the idea is to have a book for kids in the classroom that says, you know, we all make mistakes, but we get up, we learn our lessons, we dust ourselves off and get on with it. But they were actually pretty good boys while they're at school as well. So I learned about, I wanted to, through their stories, have our young people nationally get some insight into what it takes to be a leader, what it takes to reach your goals, and what you want to be when you're five may not be what you turn out to be when you're 20. For instance, both those fellas wanted to be NBA basketball legends. And Adam, I think, played soccer till he was about 14. And I don't think he kicked his first goal until he got to the Swans, where Mickey O was kicking goals when he was 5, 6, 7 and so forth. So the story of evolution for those two fellas and how they got to be where they are, but also the relationship that they have as blood family, but also Mickey O as Adam's mentor. It's really interesting.
Now, as a writer, you're probably best known for your work in commercial women's fiction, but you're prolific across the range of areas, history, children's books, etc. Is this something that you've actually pursued, trying to write in so many different styles?
There's two answers to that. One is I just want to find one genre I'm good at.
You seem to be good at all of them.
No, you know, I feel like I manage it. But it is about providing resources, in particular genres, to reach different audiences. So I started writing those commercial women's fiction because I wanted to reach those women that catch the train to work, for instance, from Penrith to Central every day, or from the Central Coast down into the city, or lie on the beach and or whatever, or in book clubs. And I thought, how do we reach these women who are 18, you know, to 45 or to 60, who may never have heard of Anita Heiss or Larissa Berendt, may have seen us marching against the anti-intervention but never understood why, or may not have even thought about us at all. How do we get on their radar? And so it was about, that was a distinct marketing / business decision to reach those women about issues that are important to me. And the one way to do that was to look at, you know, we all, as women, we have relationships with our friends, our sisters, our mothers, you know, some searching for love with men and or women or whatever, and talking about relationships and weaving the politics of identity and so forth through that. The kids' books, obviously, it's important, you know, our kids need to see themselves on the page. They need to see kids that look like them on the page, that live in areas like them on the page. So I sort of wrote those books with the kids at La Perouse to put them on the national identity radar, but also to write them into the Australian literary landscape. And similarly with the Goodes and Mickey O book, it's about getting their faces, two strong Aboriginal male leaders in the sporting community, but also, you know, they're both businessmen as well, and they're ambassadors for a range of charities. They have their own charity in the Go Foundation, and it's good for both young Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians to see that we have strong leaders like that.
We're in Beera, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, Murradabul, Murrayamin, Gujigalong, Wagaji, Bunda, Nadok Week on ABC Radio, celebrating Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander history and culture NAIDOC Week on ABC Radio.
I was born an Aboriginal into the Wiradjuri Nation, but baptised Catholic. So all my life, these two great influences been in my life. I believe that it was a hard road because Aboriginal Catholics in those days were not recognised within the church. They weren't recognised within the church. There wasn't as if the priests and nuns came to the mission and said, who's Catholic here, let's take them and have them baptised or let's take them to church. No, that wasn't allowed anyway. The manager of the mission probably wouldn't allow it. Mm. But my mother would sneak us to Mass in town. We would go down there bare feet to the church, a couple of miles to Mass, and we would go to church and sit in the back of the church. My mother had us all baptised. My father was with her. We were all baptised at St. Raphael's in Cowra, all the kids, and we all embraced the Catholic faith. So I think it was that great influence of my mum. My mum was stolen generation. She was taken at the age of 5 and taken to Cootamundra, then to a Catholic home when she was 11 and raised by the Sisters of the Good Shepherd. So here's a young person at the age of 11, not having any identity or heritage or understanding of where she's come from, embracing Catholicism. That was her strength. That was her, the people there were that took care of her. And so when my mother went out to service at the age of, 16, she was sent to Catholic homes, people that had big Catholic families to look after. So she was in service. So all her life was Catholicism. On my father's side, this is where the spiritual side comes in. My father was an initiated man who was full of spirituality and spirit stories and cultural. He was very cultural. Like he would take us in the bush and teach us all about things like how to find the witchetty grubs in the trees and how to cook them. First of all, we thought, oh, I can't swallow that. There's no way I could swallow that. But he said, you don't even know till you taste it. And they tasted like scrambled eggs, really. Mm. And these are the things we need to learn for our grassroots level. Living in camps on the banks of the Murrumbidgee River with all the other Aboriginal families around you and only our close relatives were Catholic. Mm. But it doesn't matter what religion you were, it was that you were all Aboriginal, you all lived together, you shared what you had, and you embraced your culture.
Mm.
And at the same time, when we lived on the mission, before we moved to the camps, because we got off the mission, it was every Friday my mum closing the wooden windows and doing the rosary, saying the rosary together. How precious was those moments. It was just like as if we were embracing God at that moment and our culture and our whole existence of our ancestors, that they were all speaking to us. So it was any wonder we grew up with that great love for Catholicism as well as our Aboriginality.
Auntie, what do you see the role of the church is as we move forward into the future as a community?
In the last 2 to 3 decades, the church has come a long way supporting Aboriginal Catholic people or Aboriginal people per se. They have been a great support. But I think that the future is that we need to keep it strong. Our identity is the most important thing in our lives. No one can take that away from us. Never let go of your identity. Hang on with both hands. Catholicism is another part of your life. So I think with seeing it happening in the sense that where is it going to be, I don't know. I see some down movements in the Catholic faith. I think a lot of are going another direction. Not just Catholics, they're going away from any religion. It may be the new age, maybe the new time. They are not embracing any faith or religion. And I think through that, they're losing their spirituality. You know that? I think they're losing the spiritual side of the people because, as Boniface said, we may not have had a lot of material goods, but we were full of spiritual goods. And while ever you embrace spirituality, you're embracing that spiritual side of who you are. And that gives you your identity, your assurance, and who you are.
Mm.
And I think if you lose your spirituality, that's what makes you. And I think that through Catholicism, that we can embrace spirituality, because remember, no one believed that we were spiritual people. Who believed that? If I had said that 30 years ago, people would have looked at me and laughed and said, spiritual? What sort of spirit? You Aboriginals find it at the bottom of a bottle. That's how they would speak to us. But we need as Aboriginals to embrace our spirituality. It's not about so much about religion, but embracing our spirituality and finding that root that's there and saying, that makes me who I am.
Yurda Marant, Yuin Junairi Reynolds, Balladu Wiradjuri Yina, Wadakablung Gunubu, ABC Yaldine. G'day, my name is Nairi Reynolds. I'm a Wiradjuri woman. You are listening to ABC Radio.
Well, we had a school at Wanola, the first school, because I was working on that school too. Like, I was an assistant teacher. We used to just teach out in the bowshed, under the bowshed, under the tree. We used to teach, like, both school, like, in traditional way, Garwa. Kids had to learn Garwa language and, you know, like, writing it down in Garwa and English. So it was good, and the government took that school off us. Because we was teaching in both language, you know, in Garwa and English. And it's really good. Them kids used to learn how to speak and read and write on it, the Garwa languages, you know, because Garwa language is the first language for us in Australia.
The school you mentioned got closed down. There's a lot of other pressures from government to close remote communities and take services away. What do you say to people who think that remote communities should be closed?
I think we should be talking and fighting to government and tell them that we need that education to be taught in our own community. No? Kids go to school every day when they're out in the Sandridge and Wanangal area. Some kids live at Wadawadala and Melibundura, and they still come up there to Wanangal for school because they loved it, you know, because it's got traditional culture in there, like writing and singing and dancing. That's why today our young people, they're really strong in culture. And there's, like, Scott, the only one who can speak in Garwa language. But some of them learning, because, you know, it's a really strong cultural place. Wanangal and Sandridge, even Melibundura and Wadawadala. That's where we used to live before. Culture is very important for our children to learn about the bush, the name of the country, how to look for the right food out in the bush. We teach them how to cook them, and we call it gayamba. Like, we have to cut that part of the meat and on all them different animal what we get. Like, you're cutting up the cow meat. So it's got name of that. Like, we get them kids to learn how to hunt for it and cut them up. You have to go share it around to family, even to sea turtle and dugong. The men go out with the young boys and they have to learn how to do it.
You are an artist, Auntie. What do you try and tell people through your art? Because your artwork is really rich with stories.
Yeah, well, in that painting I had to tell the story, what happened a long time ago with our elders. It's got a lot of history of our people, how they fought in the country and even didn't like the houses to be built up and the ground to be dug up. Them old people used to say, no, don't do that. And they had a big war in Wollongong, they called that place, called Mungarangaranbi. That's where they had a big fight there with first settlers came through, even the police and the military police. And it's got a lot of history story of them old people, you know. And because of that history story, and also they carry their stories in the songs, all the different songs that we sing and we dance, because they didn't know how to read and write in those days. So they carried all their stories in the song and take young people and show the country where all this been happening.
Now, the other thing that you have been very strong on is bringing awareness to the impact of mining that has happened near your country. Can you just talk to us a little bit about what your concerns have been about the mining?
In the mining at Borrowlula there at MacArthur River Mine. It's really terrible. And they should keep their, all their mess in the mining lease. But they're putting all the rubbish down to the water, to the river. That's the main place where we eat fish from. And they shouldn't be doing that. That's why we're fighting today with all our young people in Borrowlula. You know, whoever fighting with us, like some of them don't talk with us on the meeting and all that, but we're the only the one who, from Wanangal and Warawada Island, Milibundura, we're the only one fighting because we're living down the river. There's a community on both sides of the river, and we go fishing in the same river. Not only us, but non-Indigenous people, they live down from us, you know, and we're all sharing that same river, and it's all polluted. That's why we're still fighting and fighting. We need that mine to be close. No, we're not happy with it. The Glencore mine should be close.
What is the future that you would like to see for the young people in your community?
Well, I'd like to have the school going at that community, at Sandridge, and I'd like to teach their children strongly in culture, singing. They are learning very well, them kids, but we need a building to be there for the kids. Even we can teach the big boys, big girls, and like young ladies and young men. You know, if they need to learn about the languages and all that, yes, we like to teach that in that community, but we haven't got any facilities to, like houses or building to for them to teach. That's why we're looking for someone if they could help to build a house there for the school, for the kids. You know, and it's really good. Not only the Wanangal kids, so kids from the town area, if they're interested on learning it for culture and all that, they're welcome to come. We like to help every kids and teach them culture and keep the country strong and to learn about the bush and not to, we have to teach them to stop the mining people coming into the country because it's very important. The country have stories. Little River, Creek, they all got name. Aboriginal name. So this is why we want the school to be there for the young children to teach them culture very strong and to name the country and take them to the country and teach them out in the bush to keep it strong. That's what we'd like to see happening in our community. River is about 5 kilometres out from where we're staying. And it's just close. We walk down there too. But we cannot fish there anymore because we don't trust the river. And it's got a lot of history, story. Them old people used to paddle with a canoe all the way down to the mouth and through the island. I used to go with my grandfather too. He used to tell us story along the way. Now that's how I knew how to be strong in culture and all that, stories and country.
That was Auntie Nancy McDinney, an elder from Borrowlula and tireless campaigner for the protection of country. You also heard Auntie Elsie Heiss, elder and leader of the Aboriginal Catholic Ministry, her daughter and author, Dr. Anita Heiss, and Indigenous criminologist and researcher, Amanda Porter. Tonight's program has been dedicated to highlighting exceptional female leaders in the professional and community space. Each of them embodies the theme of NAIDOC Week 2018, because of her, we can. That's the show for this week. Join us again next week when we'll bring you part two of our NAIDOC Week 2018 special featuring more Indigenous women who have paved the way for change. Speaking Out is on Facebook and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au. We would love to hear from you. I'm Larissa Berendt and this is Speaking Out.